This is Dr. Mark Jennings in his teaching on the Gospel of Mark. This is session number 15 on Mark chapter 9, verses 2 through 50. Transfiguration, boy with demon, discipleship.
Good to be with you again as we continue to work through the Gospel of Mark. Today we're getting into Mark chapter 9. Specifically, we'll be starting with verse 2. But as we begin to think about Mark chapter 9, the first incident we're going to look at is one of the more well-known, is the transfiguration of Jesus. And as we work through the transfiguration, remember we're also working through this not as a event in and of itself, but also how Mark has been preparing us for the transfiguration and what the transfiguration itself prepares us for. So let's read the text, has been our custom, and then discuss what's in there. So beginning with verse 2. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. For he did not know what to say. They were terrified. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, Why do the scribes say that Elijah must come, that first Elijah must come? And he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he will suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they please, as it is written of him. When we come to the transfiguration here, one of the things that immediately stands out is there are some interesting parallels between this event and Moses going up on the mount. For example, Jesus takes disciples up with him. He takes the three disciples here that we've come to know as part of his inner circle. Moses also goes up onto the mountain, takes three unnamed figures with him along with 70 others. Jesus is transfigured. His clothes become radiantly white. And, you know, even Mark gives us this evidence about as white as it was impossible to make by bleaching. Moses' skin shines when he descends from the mountain after talking with God. And both God appears in an overshadowing cloud. There is theophany, if you will, in the Old Testament, but here as well. We even see some people being astonished. The disciples are astonished at what has happened, and so are the people when they see Moses coming down. But there are, in the middle of these references and similarities to Moses, and there's a few more even, it's certainly a place in the sense of how the Mosaic moment is lesser than what is happening here with Jesus. So as we think through this, I want to try to show some of these elements and how they play out. You know, one of the things as we work through is, again, these first three we've been accustomed. These are the ones who are allowed to see what happened to Jairus' daughter when she was dead. And they've seen that amazing miracle. Now they've seen this transfiguration. These will also be the three that Jesus takes with him at Gethsemane a little bit further. And as we think through that what these three are seeing, we need to remember also that in terms of the confusion that these three are said to demonstrate. Peter often with as a spokesperson for the 12, but even John later on will ask some questions show that they're seeing all these amazing things, but they're yet not still fully understanding. What's interesting is as they're moving up into this mount, that Mark tells us that Elijah with Moses was seen there talking with Jesus. So here, Jesus has been transfigured and he's in glory, and you know, part of the idea is wondering is this what they're actually seeing is almost the true sense of the glory of Jesus, has Jesus sometime his anticipated glorious figure that he will be when he comes into glory, what is actually being seen. But regardless, there's this glory that is being seen, and you have Elijah and Moses. Now, the order is fascinating. Elijah with Moses. In fact, usually you would expect it'd be Moses, you know, with Elijah because of the primacy of Moses. I think the Mark puts Elijah first, where the others do not. Part of stressing, I think, the eschatological moment that is here, but also the conversation that has with Elijah. But this the fact that Elijah and Moses there shouldn't be a surprise, and we do need to ask the question, why those two? And I don't think the answer is because they represent the law and the prophets. I don't think that's necessarily the answer, or at least a full complete. Moses certainly would represent the law, but Elijah, it would be an odd choice for representing the prophets. He was a prophet, but in terms of what we think of the law and the prophets, usually think of the prophetical books that were written. So one like Isaiah might have been more anticipated. And even then, it's not as clear because Moses is considered a prophet as well. So it's not as if Moses is lacking prophet designation. In fact, Deuteronomy 18 speaks of the one who would come like the prophet Moses. And I think maybe that's where we start to understand some of the reasons why Elijah and Moses might be the ones here. That both of them had a theophany experience on a mountain, no less. Both of them factor into the eschatological anticipation. You know, Elijah, you know, Malachi 4:5 speaks of Elijah's return. And look forward to the days of Elijah. Deuteronomy 18 speaks forward for when the one who's a prophet like Moses would come. And so both Elijah and Moses are two figures that really speak to the hope of God's act, the eschatological event that was coming into play. In fact, you get the sense by both of them being there that this anticipated climax now is at hand. And so I think when we ask that question of why Elijah and Moses, it's because those two figures factor so significantly in the great plan now coming to the end. And those who would accompany me will be part of that, those figures, part of that eschatological reality. Now, Peter's response I find very interesting, and Peter also gets maligned for his response. And I think to some extent, that he does as best as he can, perhaps, in that moment. First, Peter says to Jesus, Rabbi, and I don't think that Rabbi should be any indication of somehow not understanding. I mean, Jesus has been teaching. I think the Rabbi here is an acceptable designation. He says, let us make three tents, or you could also look at that as three booths, or three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And I think, you know, in some respect, recognize that what Peter is doing first is he is seemingly making an incredibly high statement about Jesus. Here was Elijah and Moses, these great figures from the past, now visible there in the present, and Peter is counting Jesus among them. You know, which is in itself a really amazing statement about Jesus. But I think also The booze is interesting because these tents, these tabernacles, because it's hard not to think about the festival of booze here as part of Peter's thinking. You know, the Feast of Tabernacles was celebrated usually in sometime what we would say September or October by our calendar after the grape harvest festival and 2 months before the dedication festival. It followed the Day of Atonement and marked the conclusion of the annual cycle of religious festivals. But what's fascinating, I think, what's important to note is this Feast of Tabernacles, what it does and how it's presented throughout the scriptural story. It begins, when you look at Leviticus and Numbers, recalling God's provision for the people in the wilderness wanderings, where they, you know, lived in these tabernacles. But then it takes on in Nehemiah and then in Zechariah more than just a remembrance of what occurred, but becomes a declaration, one, of present dependence and trust in God becomes part of that festival, that he will continue to meet. That's how it sort of gets associated with this harvest idea, that he will continue to meet the needs of his people. But with the Zechariah aspects that get pulled in, there's a eschatological aspect to this festival as well. And suppose what I'm asking us to think about is, when is this festival of booths carried almost the full story of God interacting and acting with his people, from the Exodus event to the continual sort of sustaining of the people to a forward, future-looking hope. And I wonder, then, with Peter, when he is saying, let's make three tents or tabernacles, if he's trying his best to draw upon the greatest expression of past, present, and future in terms of Jewish festivals by saying, let us make three tents. Let us do a tabernacle representation here. And so there's part of me that, when I think about Peter's response, I want to give him some credit for trying to figure out the best way to respond to this moment. But of course, he misses some of the significance here. For example, the fact, one of his mistakes is that he wants to make three instead of one. He's missing the significance that Elijah and Moses being there is in witness, if you will, in affirming what Jesus is doing. That it is not Elijah, Moses, and Jesus, but it's Elijah and Moses bearing witness and testimony to what now is occurring with Jesus' arrival. And I think that's even stressed, for example, is that even after the moment is over, the stress is on that there's still Jesus there, that Jesus remains, that there's a significance. But of course, the voice as well brings this in. So you have Peter verse six, sort of just trying to figure out what to do. He did not know what to say. He's terrified. And then almost interrupting into this scene is a cloud overshadow them, and is this voice, "This is my beloved son," an echo of Psalm 2:7. Now, this is not the first time we've had this occurrence happen in the Gospel of Mark. This is very similar to the baptism, in that where the voice, you know, from the heavens, and the heavens were split, ripped apart, and the divine testimony comes into this royal psalm declaring who Jesus is. And so we get that reminder that this is the significance of who is being viewed here. But notice also, I think, this idea of listen to him becomes important. The Father is endorsing, is advocating for the Son's words. Now, in this mosaic imagery, the mountain, the theophany, the bringing of the witness, those elements that we talked about before, you have Deuteronomy 18:15. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you." This is Moses being the "like me," "from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen." And I think what we have here then is this clear declaration with "listen to him," that Jesus is this one that Moses spoke about in Deuteronomy 18. It's hard to miss that. And then this then reminds us of what Mark has been stressing all the way through this, that Jesus had an authority unlike the scribes. That, you know, the scribes debated and discussed what Moses meant. And here is the one who's even more important than Moses being affirmed, you know, to listen to him. And so we have this scene, and then as they're coming down the mountain, he tells the three not to tell anyone. not to tell anyone about this glorified transfiguration they have witnessed, or that Moses or Elijah, until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. And so you even have there, in this messianic secret, this relationship that Jesus is wanting to connect, that I think what Moses and Elijah and God and the voice are affirming can only be fully and truly understood after the great Son of Man, Jesus, resurrects. And so you have these bringing together. And even Jesus talking about resurrection here would be an eschatological understanding. And perhaps that's a bit why the disciples have some confusion. So in verse 10, they kept the matter to themselves. It's one of the few occasions where Jesus tells someone to be quiet about something, and they actually are. So we want to give them credit. But questioning what the rising from the dead might mean, and I think that's important for us to continue to remind ourselves, is when we look at the disciples, and they don't seem to get what Jesus is saying when he keeps talking about how he will rise again on the third day, or the Son of Man must be risen, that for them the resurrection was not something that happened in the middle of history to one person. The resurrection was something that was supposed to happen at the end of history to the faithful people of God. And so when they're sitting here talking about what do you think he means when he says that until the Son of Man had risen from the dead, it's because there's no place in their understanding of how things are, should play out in their mind that fits this. One, a resurrection being associated with the Son of Man doesn't fit, but also a particular person rising from the dead as opposed to the collective would be something that they're just would be struggling with, and that they wouldn't, have the benefit that we have of looking backwards into this and knowing what Jesus is talking about. They did not. And I think we need to always recognize the difficulty that they would have had. Of course, with these references to resurrection, with these references to Elijah and this vision of Elijah, it's natural that they asked him about the role that Elijah plays in all of this. And keep in mind that this question about the role Elijah plays with that also probably stems from the fact that there are people saying that Jesus is Elijah. We already saw that when Jesus asked the disciples, who do the crowd say that I am? And they replied, some say you're Elijah. So the Elijah atmosphere is certainly ripe. And so they ask him, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? Jesus' response is interesting, and actually the logic, I think, sometimes is a bit hard to follow here. Jesus responds first with seeming to affirm what the scribes are saying, which is a rarity. Jesus doesn't usually affirm the correctness of the scribes, but he says Elijah does come first to restore all things. Now, this idea that Elijah, comes first to restore all things, coming off Malachi 4:5-6, which reads, "See, I will send the prophet Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the parents to their children, and the hearts of the children to their parents, or else I will come and strike the land with total destruction." And Elijah's arrival, his departure feeds into this mystery of his arrival too, in 2 Kings 2:11, and how Elijah leaves. And so this question then becomes about Elijah coming first, and Jesus affirms it. And even says Elijah does come first to restore all things. But yet after making that statement, and not even really defining what restore all things means, he then issues a statement about the Son of Man. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? This was one of the point of debates. Jesus has been saying that it is necessary that the Son of Man be rejected by the leaders and be killed. And the disciples are having a hard time understanding how the great victory of the Son of Man can at all be connected with what seems to be such a horrible prediction. And I believe what Jesus is doing here by saying, first affirming the Elijah statement, but then connecting it with his teaching on the Son of Man, is challenging the disciples to rethink what Elijah coming to restore all things actually means. In fact, he says in verse 13, but I tell you that Elijah has come. And this is seen as Jesus' reference that this Elijah figure was John the Baptist. That John the Baptist is fulfilling this Elijah requirement. That Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they please, as it is written of him. And this would be the connection between, this would be the statement about John the Baptist, who was executed by Herod Antipas. And so in this statement, what Jesus is doing is saying, just as you must rethink the victory that the Son of Man brings, you must also rethink the Elijah forerunner and what that would look like. And so if the restoration of all things is pointing towards the great victory over all things, but yet the great victory over all things is in suffering and death, then it makes sense that the restoration is also in similar garb, that the Elijah figure would suffer similarly. In other words, the great restoration of all things is to be understood in what Christ is accomplishing on the cross. That the great suffering of the Son of Man on the cross is indeed the great victory. And Elijah, John the Baptist, pointing towards that is the restoration. And that that John the Baptist is preparing the people for the arrival. And so I think this is how what Jesus is trying to get them to understand here is the statement that Elijah does come first to restore all things is not incorrect, but that their understanding of that is incorrect. We're going to see something similar even happen in Mark 13 when we get to that chapter. All right, I want to continue then here thinking through Mark chapter 9 and looking here at verses 14 through 29. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And so the scene is, right, this is they're returning to the disciples. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked, what are you arguing about with them? And someone from the crowd said, teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able. And he answered them, O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me. And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And it has cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible for one who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe, help my unbelief. And when Jesus saw that the crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? And he said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. They went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know. Looking at here, this passage in 14 through 29 is fascinating here. Fascinating. Because we've moved from this great moment of transfiguration back into the sort of everyday of Jesus' ministry, which is the disciples not getting something right or being confused, and the need for help and aid in the demonic exorcism. We even have evidence that this demon has been around for a while, since this boy's childhood, that he's destructive, as we would expect. We continually see the demons trying to be destructive. And here, this is something we have as well. He's trying to destroy the boy, throwing him into fire, throwing him into water. But what's interesting is there are two interactions. First, this first interaction is with this man, and this man is pleading for help. He's gone to the disciples, and they were not able to do it. Which we know the disciples have just come from a ministry experience where they were able to cast out demons. And then we have, and before Jesus turns to engage with the man, we have this this rebuke by Jesus. Oh, faithless generation, which, as we've talked about, I really believe that this negative generation language is to connect what is currently happening with the doubt of the Israelites that were wandering the wilderness. And so I think this, oh, faithless generation, you know, this present generation has unbelief. But then he turns into this with this father, and the father who's made the muscular act, if you will, of trying to get this boy to Jesus. He asks the question, but if you can do anything, help us. And Jesus is indignant at that response, and it's the if you can language. This is in stark contrast to if you are willing, I will be clean. Here is, if you can, please do this. The if you can language indicates that the man has some concern that Jesus' power may be sufficient enough. And the reason he has this concern is because the disciples have shown themselves to be insufficient to the task. And so this inability of the disciples has now been transferred over to a concern over inability of Jesus. And so the challenge Jesus gives back to him is, with all things are possible for one who believes, is a challenge to show faith. And we've seen this through Mark, that Jesus wants a muscular response, wants a clear response of faith in Jesus before he will respond in the miracle. If one does not believe that Jesus can do this, then Jesus does not do this. That's the pattern we've been seeing in Mark. And then we have, I think, probably one of this greatest statements about faith. And a statement, I think, that really encapsulates the right response. The father of the child cries out two things. One, I believe. Well, that in and of itself could simply be a response to, oh, I do believe. But it's the second statement that perhaps shows even more faith. Help my unbelief. It is this humble recognition that there is a lack of faith there, but that lack of faith is his own weakness, and that Christ is the one who can grow and solidify the faith. And indeed, this is a great cry, I think, of discipleship that the disciples themselves are not getting. We're going to see play out how often the disciples are quite confident in their abilities. They show a lack of concern over inabilities. In fact, some of their boasting that happens later on regarding who will be great and who will be greatest, or even Peter, when we get to the final in the Passion Week and his bold declaration that, you know, if everyone else falls away, he will stay with Jesus till the end. That they work in this sort of boldness statement, and perhaps what they need is help my unbelief. And so Jesus then receives this statement as evidence of faith. And he rebukes the unclean spirit. There's a command there and an immediacy of that command. Now, that is what we would expect. This whole moment actually seems like something we've seen earlier in the gospel. that characterize the first eight chapters, if you will. But we are in this section on teaching, where the attention from Caesarea Philippi has been Jesus teaching the disciples. And one of the things that does stand out in this element is the teaching aspect that occurs. So we have, after the exorcism, we have him sort of enter the house and him having this discussion with the disciples privately. This is looking here at verse 28, where they're asking, why could we not cast it out? And the response is interesting. This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. So the question, of course, is why they could not do it, but yet Jesus could. And the heart is the disciples' failure. Maybe part of the answer is in this response to Jesus. Jesus says this could only be cast out by prayer, and I don't think what he means is a specific formula or saying, but rather it's that posture of prayer that dependence that prayer is. You know, prayer is when one turns their face toward God in a declaration that God is creator, and we are created, that God is the one who designs and directs, and we don't have anything to contribute on our own. And maybe we're getting this hint when Jesus responds by this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer, that the disciples were beginning to think about more what they were able to do on their own, rather than realizing a need for the power of God in this. So the response I find interesting. I want to quickly begin moving on here and maybe finish out chapter 9 if we could. So I'd like to look at verses 30 through 50. They went off from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand the saying and were afraid to ask. I want to talk a little bit about those two verses. One of the things that we notice here on these two verses is that we have our next passion prediction. We've been seeing Jesus do this. This is our next one in verse 31. And so here we also have a reason for the messianic secret, if you will, in this aspect, that he's telling the disciples not to tell anyone about what they know because he has teaching he wants to do. And if the spread, you know, continues of his popularity, it might prevent or at least make difficult some of this teaching. And so he predicts he's going to be delivered. But one thing I think is important to note here is he's going to be delivered into the hands of men. And I think the hands of men might indicate in this prediction who is doing the delivering. This isn't a delivering from one group of men to another group of men. And notice this isn't we handed over to the rulers or to the judges or to the leaders, might put, you know, a particular group. It's into the hands of men. And I think then what we're seeing here is in verse 31 that the one who is actually delivering the Son of Man over to the hands of men is God. I think that's the idea behind it, that God is doing this delivering. And this would actually fit with what is said of the suffering servant in Isaiah. He is said to be delivered over. Paul will use very similar language about delivering, where God is the one who delivers and hands over. And so we're getting, I think, a hint at the divine orchestration of the passion as well. And they will kill him. I think evidence that this is not a creation of the early church is the language of kill him instead of crucify him, which is what one would have expected if it was an insertion into the scene. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. And then verse 33, and they came to Capernaum, which is not a surprise. This is usually where when he's his home base when he's in Galilee. And when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? verse 34 is interesting that they kept silent. And I think as we're starting to see, disciples will often keep silent when they know that there's some embarrassment or shame associated with it. But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. Now, this argument with one another about who was the greatest seems especially egotistical in a 21st century Western context. But keep in mind, in the ancient world, where everything was understood in honor and shame, that they would be boasting in themselves a little bit about who would be in what status wouldn't have been as uncommon. And Jesus clearly speaks against it, but that they were doing that would be reflected, of that culture where everything seemed to be a competition. Now, so this they realize that this is inappropriate. I think that's why they kept silent, that they've been listening enough to Jesus' teaching to know that what they were arguing over is probably something he won't agree with. And indeed, he does make this a teaching moment. He sat down and called the 12. That has that idea of seating, has the idea of now there's going to be a lesson on it. And he said to them, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And so this is the teaching objective, if you will, that the rest of it is going to follow. This is the main idea, sort of this reversal of how you understand status. Whoever receives one such, and he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. Now, I want to just finish there, and we may have time to do the rest of 9. If not, we'll pick it up at the next lesson. I'm sure we'll pick it up at the next lesson. But I think what we need to realize is what's happening here in terms of what a child is in the ancient world, and a little bit to how we think naturally of a child. When we think of a child, especially in the West, we tend to think of child as the perfect display of innocence, of having been untainted, of potential, ready. In a lot of ways, a child in the ancient world wasn't thought of in similar ways culturally. And I'm not talking about a father and a son in their care, a father and a wife in their care for the son or daughter, but children in general were a group that lacked status. Children were a group that had no sort of social significance, if you will. They were dependent, they were weak, they were unable to contribute. And so when we look, Jesus has said, he's talking about this distinction between this argument the disciples are having about who's going to be the greatest, and to display the importance of this reversal of first and last, he picks not something innocent, but something of low status and low value. The child becomes the expression of a lower ring in the honor shame category, if you will, as the world would understand it. And so what he says is whoever receives one such child, and I don't think this means that whoever receives children, but I think the child here is the metaphor, perhaps, is the best way of putting it, or the symbol. Whoever sees one such low status, whoever doesn't think status in my name, and I think the in my name reference here is interesting. Does it go to the receiving, or does it go to the child? That's one of the debate. Is it whoever in my name or receives in my name one such child, or is it whoever receives one such child in my name, meaning the in my name associated with child? And I think the sense of it here might be to associate the in my name language with child, right? In other words, whoever receives a low status person who is a follower of mine, who claims to belong to me, receives me. This is much more closer to what we usually we've seen Jesus say about how the reception of the followers of Jesus is the reception of Jesus, and to reject the followers of Jesus is to reject him. To reject the message that the disciples are carrying is to reject the one about who the message proclaims, that Jesus continually interweaves throughout his teaching the connection between reception and rejection of his followers with reception and rejection of him. And I think this is what's happening in this context, that what Jesus is saying, whoever receives the lowliest of people in social status world, but who claim to be a follower of mine, they are receiving me. They are receiving, you know, the Messiah. And whoever, and conversely, whoever receives me, whoever says, yes, you know, I welcome Jesus into my presence, receives not me, but the one who sent me, here being a reference to the Father. And as we work through thinking about children and metaphor, I want us to keep that in mind, because I think what we're going to see this plays out is it's about social status, not about purity, innocence, and potential. I want to pick up the rest of chapter 9 and as we move into chapter 10 the next time. Thank you.
This is Dr. Mark Jennings in his teaching on the Gospel of Mark. This is session number 15 on Mark chapter 9, verses 2 through 50. Transfiguration, Boy with Demon, Discipleship.